Welcome to session 4D, 7UP, the appointing actuary in the Australian Private Health Insurance 7 years on, by Stuart Roger. Stuart is a partner in Deloitte and the head of the actuarial health practice there. His focus is on the strategic issues that impact health financing. His clients include both government and insurers. He's currently the AA for two health insurers in Australia. His career has taken him into roles in Australia, UK, Singapore, and Japan. Prior to joining Deloitte nearly 10 years ago, it included a wide range of other positions, including corporate development strategy, marketing, various actuarial roles, including AA of a life insurer in the UK, leader of a superannuation business, and 5 years as a director of a life insurer. Stuart is a member of the Institute's Health Practice Committee and its past convener. Just a bit of housekeeping. The format is that Stuart will spend probably half an hour going through his slides and then have questions at the end. Please turn off your mobile phones, especially Peter Carroll, if he's not here. Feedback forms, don't forget to complete your feedback forms, and please don't fold them, and someone will collect it at the back, probably Peter, he's sitting at the door. And when you have questions, please come up to the microphone, state your name and speak clearly. And yeah, welcome, Stuart.
Thanks, Ben. So this paper follows on from a kind of discussion that took place during most of last year among the appointed actuary community and FEAC about what should this role be going on. And the explicit aim of this paper is to take that discussion out of just the appointed actuary circle and put it into the wider profession. And it fits quite neatly with Raywin and Adams' paper yesterday, which presented some findings on the outcomes. Right? So I've got a kind of a picture all the way through here about how the appointed actuary role should work. This doesn't just apply to private health insurance. It applies more generally. The picture, to be squashed into our PowerPoint, has smaller font, so I'm going to go over here for a moment and I will come back to this picture, but we have, first of all, outcomes, which is what was reported on yesterday.
We all fellas can't read.
No, that's right. It's also on the back page of the paper, and everyone has a copy of the paper, hopefully, still. Okay, so the outcomes which come from this were reported on yesterday, but you don't get outcomes by just kind of sitting there and dreaming of the outcomes. To put outcomes in place that are systematic and repeatable, you actually need a whole stack of things. You need processes. You also need people. You need good communication, and you need it surrounded by a philosophy, and then surrounding that, you need a sense of professionalism and the kind of stuff Simon Longstaff was talking about what to expect from the actuarial profession, is really that blue square surrounding this. And it's really important when we think about our role that we think in all these dimensions. So it follows on quite logically from yesterday's presentation, which reported on outcomes. Now we need to talk about 7 years on, what do we do for the next 7 years, and how have we moved during those 7 years. And as I said at the beginning, this will put into more public domain some of the discussions that have been taking place among the appointed actuary community. So I'm going to talk in some ways to the paper. Everyone's got a copy of the paper. In Plan A, you all had a copy from the website 4 weeks ago. In Plan B, you had a copy 4 minutes ago when you walked into the room, and we don't have to worry about Plan C because Plan B is working. We're going to go through the early days, the creation of the role, the years we've been past when the role's consolidated, then move on to what next. A couple of things about the early days of the role. It was created under FEAC regulatory powers. Well, that's very interesting when you read the FEAC circular that told insurers they had to have an appointed actuary, circular from 2004. It doesn't actually cite any power that they're exercising in doing that. Nevertheless, okay, so just for the posterity here, the previous, an unnamed person has just said that it was all bluff. But nevertheless, it worked, and by the end of 2004, everyone had an appointed actuary. The broad ride from that is it came into being, and then it got formalised, and then it got commercialised, well, sealed in commercialism, and now we need to look about what next. The early stages, there was pricing, new product development, discretionary margin, risk margin for accounting, and a financial condition report. When you stand back and look at those... Okay, we're going to come back to this. When you stand back and look at those, each of those are just discrete jobs. And when you think about what triggers them, it's not the appointed actuary who triggers them. So those five things are quite a reactive set of things to do. And then the magic that bound them together, there were two pieces of magic. One was that FEAC required to be told who was the appointed actuary, and within a few weeks of changing that, they needed to be told that you'd changed your appointed actuary and who the new one was. And as a result, there was a continuous occupation of the role. And then the other piece of magic was a combination of FEAC and the profession, and a piece of actuarial technology that the profession's been developing for 20 years, and that was the financial condition report. And a guidance note put together, GN 670, specifically to match the requirement for the appointed actuary. When you look at the requirements in GN 670, you cannot get to 30 June and start work. Even for the smallest insurer, if you haven't had any kind of finger on the pulse during the year, you cannot hope to meet the requirements even of GN 670, let alone the professional standard we're now about to launch. And what that did was, bit by bit, each company had to introduce, as appropriate for them, their own form of the actuarial control cycle. So when I look back at the launch of the appointed actuary role, excellent bluff, excellent pre-selling, right? If you look at, it took 2 years. There was a discussion paper, lots of industry seminars, a big thing near Sydney Airport where chief executives of insurers told other people of the industry how important it was to have this role. The thing was incredibly well sold, right? So we might laugh that it was bluff, but in fact it was a need whose time had arisen and the industry bought into it. And having bought into it, they expect us to perform. From the beginning, it was positioned as, even in the initial circular, an advisor to the board and to management, right? So the appointed actuary is required to be advising directly the board. The Institute supported it with a guidance note, with advice with FEAC. We had an actuary who was deputy commissioner, and I think that was a good source of informal guidance or idea sounding. The Institute also, in the first few months after the launch of it, ran a session. We got in a APRA commissioner, Steve Summergee, Professor of Actuarial Studies, David Service, very high-profile seminar at that time on how this role should work, attended by almost all the appointed actuaries, not quite all of them, and lots of their teams that are supporting them as well. So there was a lot of work from the Institute and from members who are of the Institute, members of the Health Practice Committee, who preceded my involvement in this, and a lot of work was done behind the scenes to bring this about. The results, I think I have some numbers here, and I'm going to come back to that. So some numbers. These are all approximate. I could probably go to FEAC's database and get them out exactly, and if people think we should do that, we'll approach that afterwards. But I reckon there were 40 positions in 2004, held by 13 people, and I think the maximum held by one person was 15, but I'm not putting that in the paper because that's just a discussion point. And I don't know what's the maximum held today, but there's still 12 people today. And when you look at the turnover, five people who were appointed actuaries in that first tranche are not now, for various reasons. And four people who are appointed actuaries today, I think it's four, were not then. And three other people have come in, performed the role for a period, and then moved on. And I draw a conclusion from that, that what we've set up, we've got some stability, but we haven't got stagnancy going on in that turnover. Right, let's move on. There's one other element. Hang on, I'm going the wrong way here. I talked about private health insurance appointed actuaries as similar but different to the appointed actuaries in other disciplines. I think in each of the disciplines where we have that role, there's a central core business problem, and it's different in each of those areas, right? So for life insurance, the central core business problem is you have these things going on long into the future, and you need to manage stability on a very long-term basis for promises you've made in the past to your customers. And that brings a whole set of problems. In general insurance, you make your promises basically once a year to your customers, but you've got a huge degree of uncertainty about how they're going to turn out. And your core business problem is to manage that uncertainty. And you've got all the tricks of the trade, the pricing, risk-based pricing, etc., all the statistical techniques, etc., to help you do that. Right? In private health insurance, the core business problem is that we're not allowed to price our risks, and yet we still have to manage a risk pool. And that is every bit as technical as the other two areas are in a different way. You heard in the plenary session yesterday someone talking about changing social... someone was talking about changing social trends, and you cannot in the EU now risk rate based on gender, and what the community will accept as a basis for discrimination is changing, right? So we're in one of the forefronts of that, that how do you manage a stable risk pool when you cannot discriminate in pricing? And, of course, we've got the sovereign risk.
And we've got a long-term commitment as well.
So, Brent, I'll come back to that when we come to the questions, because that is a good point, and I thought about putting it here. I'm going to move on, though, quickly. We've got the next 5 years, establishing the role. So a couple of things to say here, and we're into section three now. So the first thing about establishing the role, we got this role, we didn't have any formal training. We'd had two brilliant residential courses, 1998 and 2000. And I know they're brilliant not because I was there. It was years before I got involved. I know they were brilliant because I've gone back and looked at the material, and it was brilliant. But very difficult to repeat. So we got to 2005. It's the Institute's job, no one else's, to put together training material to make this role repeatable. And we did that. And the really interesting thing there is that every appointed actuary contributed to that material. The course we've got now was written by the appointed actuaries of the time. So here's a profession handing on to people not inside this closed circle their knowledge about what's going on. I think that's something which is worth thinking about, how we don't just make that once only at that time, but as a Simon Longstaff thing about how we build that continuity in passing on the knowledge. Come back, make a plug at the end. If I get through my things quickly, we'll have plenty of time for plugs. We're about to relaunch the PHI course again because it's been updated a second time. The second thing that was done was the Private Health Insurance Act. And with this came a formal role and a formal continuous role. And the Institute and HPC and senior actuaries worked with the Department of Health and Ageing to make sure that the appointed actuary sections of this act really would work. We had a session where a number of actuaries flew to Canberra, and we had a meeting in Canberra Airport in the Qantas Lounge with Charles Maskell Knight and people from FIAC and other people from the department who were drawing up the legislation, and just talked through how this would actually work in practice. And as a result, some lessons were learnt from what APRA does, and also some things applicable to private health insurance were included. The Act gives us powers as appointed actuaries. They are powers. Right? We have a power to ask for information and expect to get it. We have a power to ask people to tell us things. Right? We have a power to turn up to a meeting that we're not necessarily welcome at, although in most cases I think we are welcome. The point is, we have powers. These are not things which you throw into the ether and hope someone listens. These are powers. We also have something called qualified privilege, which means that we don't have to think as carefully about what we put in our report. Sorry. We don't have to be as defensive about what we put in our reports as what we would have to be if we didn't have that, right? And different people will say it's worth a lot or it's not worth much. But I think the fact that it's in the Act is an important symbol of how fearless our advice needs to be. Moving on to section 3.3, the insurer obligation rules. So, fine, the Act is there, it lays out heads of power, but someone then has to kind of lay out how that works. And the insurer obligations rules lay out how the appointed actuary role should work. The magic here is we're still struggling with how do you get this continuous responsibility? How do you step away from it's a particular set of set pieces of work, right? And create this kind of ongoing obligation to provide advice. The notifiable circumstances do that. They came out of some understanding of how things worked in superannuation in the 90s. One of the appointed actuaries had a background in that, and he's not here today, but he threw that idea in. And we had a meeting of Health Practice Committee. Paul Groenewegen was there, and it kind of gelled in that meeting, and then Paul went away and shaped it very well. So I'm giving a bit of a personal plug here, I think, to Paul, although others would have been involved in that as well. The notifiable circumstances, it's a great phrase, but it's a little bit unfortunate because in some industries, notifiable circumstances are only bad things. In most cases in this industry, they're intended to be good things like a rate review or a new distribution channel or a new product or a new strategy that's going to expected to be worked. So they're not adverse events. There's a list here in the paper. I'm not going to go through them. The thing I will say is that every appointed actuary has to figure out with their company just how that is going to work. And in every case, that will be different. It'll be a mixture of formality and informality. If it all becomes formal, then bits slip through the holes because you can never design a formal system to cope with every situation. You basically need a lot of understanding, good communication. And one of the tricks, though, that I think just about everyone's adopting now is to put in the financial condition report a list of the notifiable circumstances that have arisen during the year. Because if nothing else, that allows you to identify with hindsight that a few were missed and in the concept of the control cycle, do it better next time around. So other people have, different people have different ways of doing it, but that, I think that practice is probably informally just going to be spread. And probably is in the, I'm not sure if it's in the professional standard that's coming. I'm moving on to section 3.4. There are some, we have powers. We also have a couple of obligations, right? If we see that the insurer that we're the appointed actuary of might be breaking the Private Health Insurance Act, the Act requires us to tell them in writing that might happen. If we see that the way in which they might be breaking the Private Health Insurance Act might have an impact on policyholders, we are required to tell FEAC in writing, not give the company a chance to fix it and then decide whether it's necessary to tell FEAC. We're actually required to tell FEAC. And then also, if within 21 days of us telling the company that they might be breaking the Act, they haven't taken some kind of appropriate action, again, we're required to tell FEAC. Right. So there's nothing on the public record about whether any appointed actuary has felt obligated to tell FEAC something under this section, so I have no comments on whether or not that works. So far I've been talking about consolidating the role through training, through formalisation in the Act. A really, I think, important piece of consolidation of our role also came with the wave of demutualisations, because big money was at stake, big corporate events were happening, and the appointed actuary had a series of roles. A formal role, fitting in with the FEAC rules relating to that, a more commercial role, because some of the reports that from the appointed actuary when the report from the appointed actuary goes in the information memorandum, it's really important to all the stakeholders that, A, it makes sense, but also, B, that the policyholders can see that what the case is about there. So there's a commercial element to that. And then informally behind the scenes, even the consideration of a demutualisation, I believe, is a notifiable circumstance. And you talk to any of the appointed actuaries involved in those, they were all involved in the pre-advice and decisions, some more, some less, you know, so there's room for, you know, could I have been more involved or did I have to be that involved? But I think in a big way, the demutualisations consolidated the appointed actuary role. There's a little capstone to the arch there. One of the things that must now have the advice is the allocation of shares. Right? So the allocation of shares is a really important outcome of a demutualisation, and there the appointed actuary has to sign off on it. Consolidating the role through serious commercial events. There's other rules under the Private Health Insurance Act as well, but I won't go into them. So consolidating the role, training, formal legislation, serious commercial requirement. There's a fourth thing that's required before we actually have a role instead of just a bunch of gifted individuals who happen to do a particular job at a particular time. And that is, a role carries on regardless of the people in it. You need a second generation of people coming through. Part of the reason I'm doing this today is because the first generation know all this stuff and, in fact, spent a lot of 2010 consolidating it and reminding each other. Part of the reason I'm doing this whole session is so that the people who will take over this role get an insight into these kind of issues. There's been a number of new appointed actuaries created since 2005. Some of those have set precedents for what's required. There are eligibility conditions, but necessarily they're very broad, and in practice, what does it actually take to say this person should take on the role? Well, there's a few precedents now for that. I've got a paragraph here. I'm just going to read it out. One can argue that the real test of whether any role's been successfully established is the quality of the second generation to take it on. This is in section 3.7. Well, it's not the function of this paper to make that judgment. I do think we've succeeded in that. But it's just interesting, isn't it? If a role is really worth doing, then once the trail has been blazed, high-quality people will seek to take that role on because it's really well worth doing. So there's the test of another test of does this appointed actuary role work. A couple of things about the taking over. Since that first wave of appointed actuaries, all of the people to then take on the role subsequently have been based in consultancies where there's been strong peer review available. We haven't yet had the situation of an employed appointed actuary taking it on for the first time. No doubt that'll happen, and we'll need to understand just how that can work. And also, I made the point before, a number of insurers have changed from one experienced appointed actuary to another. Again, for a variety of reasons, some of them bad and some of them good. I'm not looking at anyone when they say good, but there's been a couple of bad situations that shouldn't have arisen as well, companies doing the wrong thing. But I think the point there is that the appointed actuary role is not immune from commercial pressures, and neither should it be. Turning to the future, and I'm on to section four. So what we've done is we've created the role, we've then consolidated the role. So here we are today with a consolidated role. In the sense of, do we stand still with what we've got or do we need to do more? What are the issues and things we need to deal with going forward? Where can we get better, more relevant? Things will change. We need to be involved with those changes. First one, financial difficulties, an ongoing issue which everyone hopes not to get involved with, but it does happen from time to time. The appointed actuary doesn't actually have the power to keep an insurer from financial difficulties. don't have the power, but we do have the influence. Even influence isn't enough. So a real test for us when the financial difficulties come along is that, is there a well-argued case to the company pointing out the risk of whatever it was eventuating and having some kind of bottom draw plan for what to do if that risk actually eventuated, right? So if you find a company getting into financial difficulties and then you find those two things in place from the appointed actuary, around the industry, the respect for the appointed actuary role will grow. If you don't find those in place, then our own respect won't grow. And you'll find, when I'm talking about the future, a lot of the measure that I've used and or the aspiration I've used, respect for the role growing from the industry primarily. We move on also under the heading of financial difficulties. This is where the test of character comes in, right? So the appointed actuary is not a technician, not even just a commercial animal. The appointed actuary needs to meet some of those ethical requirements, which, again, that was a brilliant intro to this session, actually. We should have had it playing again on the loop as everyone walked in. We need to be exercising judgments which are not just about the economics. They're about the way in which the different stakeholders are treated. Ian Birmingham talks about the community surrounding a health insurer. And I used to argue with that. I actually think it's quite a good concept, though, because it involves all the stakeholders being treated fairly in line with their expectations. And there's value judgments in there. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. I've stolen some of these words, but I've also inserted my own. So these are my own view. At the top of page 10, the last two paragraphs of section 4.2. It's not always easy for an advisor to be the bearer of difficult or unwelcome news, especially when this is about having to manage risks which may never eventuate. Yet the provision of such advice, delivered in a way which leaves the audience in no doubt about what's meant, is at the heart of the task that every person who accepts appointment as an appointed actuary must accept. It's at the heart of the task. Advice being given to the board of an insurer should be unfettered by management and board sensitivities, while not allowing the message to be obscured or undermined by the delivery style. Standing shouting won't achieve anything in most situations. And it also should be unencumbered by considerations of the actuary's own position or standing. Simon Longstaff made a point, and I happened to be sitting beside Gail, and I opened this and showed her that sentence, right? Unencumbered by considerations of the actuary's own position or standing. We're expected to be somewhat selfless. Some good adjectives: direct, unambiguous, fearless, they're appropriate. But at the same time, advice that's arrogantly or too aggressively phrased or delivered, it can be just as counterproductive as advice which is too softly phrased. And an appointed actuary is expected to know already, when they take on this role, how to steer between those traps. You don't get to take on the role and then discover that these traps exist and then sometime later figure out how to deal with it. You learn that beforehand, and then you've got that bit of the equipment to take on the role. So I have used some words from other people there, but I have changed them, and I've slightly changed what the other people said as well. And the result is, these are what I think. Still on the theme of the future, there are industry developments in place. I've picked out a couple. These slides are not nearly as interesting as the paper, are they? But I'm onto this slide here. So there's a wave of particularly the larger insurers and now the Alliance as well, looking at the business case for wellness and preventative health, and you've got HCF with Healthways. There are business cases lying around here, but they're all still quite exploratory. And so to the extent that the appointed actuary and the people supporting that person can make those cases sounder, can make the case for some kind of virtuous cycle of better health leading to better outcomes, leading to more money to invest in better health, leading to better health. To the extent we can play a part in that, that's a development for the next 7 years, which was not really an opportunity in 2004. I'm going to jump around in the paper here. Customization versus standardization. We've got this big issue of a Medibank at one end, a Cessnock at the other. There are cost pressures, but there's no room for an appointed actuary to have failed to perform the role required. And as a result, each appointed actuary needs to have developed a product, right, which can be tested. Does this product work? You'll see it on the diagram when I get back to the end, right? Does it work? Is it efficiently delivered at an acceptable price? Does it meet the customer's key specific requirements, which are different all through the spectrum of our industry? And is it robust enough, the product that the appointed actuary delivers, is it robust enough to still work in unexpected situations? You can apply those tests to a car, you can apply them to a bar of chocolate, you can apply them to the appointed actuary's product. It's just, we're selling something, we provide something, we get paid for it, those tests need to work. What it means in practice is that each appointed actuary has developed for each client their own mix of standardised processes and informal processes. And again, good communication needs to bind them. Assets were less of an issue in 2004. I'm on to section 4.6, and I'm going to come back to 4.4 more towards the end. The financial crisis created a greater awareness of what actually can go wrong in health insurers' assets. FEAC have been particularly clear in asking the appointed actuaries to deal more explicitly and in a way that leads to outcomes with issues like large specific asset exposures, in-house assets, the extent to which insurers are relying on someone, and the point is not they rely on someone outside the insurer. The point is whether in doing that they kind of step back from taking responsibility, and once they do that, then if something goes wrong, they're saying it's not my fault. That's not an acceptable situation to get into. So you rely on third parties, but you still need to be able to assess the reasonableness of what they've done, and that particularly applies in the asset space. And the appointed actuary is probably one of the best educated professionals advising them to assess whether the reliance that they're giving on the investment specialists is a good reliance. Contagion analysis, where you're part of a larger group. Another thing FEAC's asked for is that instead of kind of giving a negative assurance, we didn't see anything wrong with the asset base, we give a positive assurance. This asset base is appropriate for this insurer, their policies and their strategies. Another one, section 4.6, risk and variability and alternative scenarios. So projections, central projections, well established in the industry. The accounting standards required stochastic variability to be taken into account, so at least the audit committees now are getting some feed on the stochastic variability, but that's just still variability around what you expect, right? The real issue for uncertainty in our business is the sovereign risk, all the environmental risks, and the strategic risks that come from strategic decisions. None of them can be measured stochastically. All of those need to be tested by the use of scenarios. And in the end, boards who are making decisions need to understand very well the kind of outcomes that are possible if everything doesn't go as expected. Because you know what? Nothing ever goes as expected. And again, respect for the appointed actuary who can communicate that, not in a way which says to the board, oh, it's very difficult to make a decision because so much is uncertain, but in a way which empowers a board to make decisions despite the uncertainty, in full recognition of the uncertainty. That's where the respect for the role grows. Capital. Our industry doesn't have the normal capital flows of most industries, and I missed Peter's paper yesterday, but I'm sure it gave a lot of great stuff. I need to read the paper. I haven't read the paper. Sorry, Peter. but capital is an issue, and I'm not going to say much more about that, apart from I still think an awful lot of insurers don't have a capital management plan, particularly a capital management plan which allows the board to assess business investments against this is what our capital, what does it do to our capital. It doesn't. A lot of insurers, I think, don't yet have a capital management plan which empowers the board to make better decisions, right? And I have no evidence for that other than anecdotal. Stepping back, we're doing all that in the future, and all the while we're managing stakeholders. And the stakeholders, board members, senior management, regulators, others, so Department of Health and Ageing is a stakeholder. For some funds, the advisor to the health minister is a stakeholder. Customers are stakeholders. The ombudsman is a stakeholder. There's a lot of stakeholders who the appointed actuary can come in contact with. Not all of those stakeholders will agree with each other about how they should be relating to the appointed actuary or what business the appointed actuary has with them. And that can be particularly the case when times are difficult, when there's problems arisen. So that it's really important that before any difficulties arise, the appointed actuary has created the necessary stakeholder relationships so that they already exist when you need them. It's no use trying to create a relationship with a key director when suddenly he's the problem or she's the problem. You need to have created that relationship of trust back when there was no problem, and then you can wheel it out. That I'm calling about the exercise of soft power, influence and soft power and relationship. However, we do have legislative powers. There are things we can do just because we want to do them. And, you know, it doesn't. We can't do them if it's a bad decision, but if there are things that are necessary for our view of how we should do the job, we have power. And that makes us, the appointed actuary, a stakeholder as well. And we should not be approaching things on the basis of it's the other stakeholders who need to get what they need, the best balance. We're a stakeholder as well. And in some limited situations, we need to exercise raw, naked power. And we need to do it skillfully, and I emphasise that word skillfully, because I didn't say it in the paper. I personally think there's an awful lot of actuarial career paths which go nowhere near naked, raw power. A lot of the actuarial stuff is about there's a case to be made, there's analysis to be done, there's options that fall naturally out of that. Well, I will help you choose the options you want to choose. Very rarely do we exercise fiat. But we do have some scope for exercising power, and in my experience, among powerful people, when someone exercises power skillfully, the respect goes sky high. Right. So I have put in here a sentence that says, in that managing of stakeholders, the appointed actuary needs to act like a stakeholder, needs mostly, because of the nature of our task, to be exercising soft power and influence, but needs to recognise the moment at which, like the dog that's been pushed too far, we snap, we bark, we don't bark, we bite, we have power, and we do it skillfully, surgically, not nuclear. Right? And that way the respect for our role grows. These are all things for the next 7 years. These are things which, with the benefit of the last 7 years, we can see coming. And to me, I started with this picture. I'm going to finish with this picture as well. It's there at the back. It's got some things in it which may make a bit more sense now. If I can. So we have the appointed actuary process, the basic product. It's got the control cycle. It's got notifiable circumstances. It's got particular set piece jobs and reports. It's got a stack of relationship and stakeholder management. It's got the expanding and the developing and the improvements and the next things that need to be done, not just always the last things. And it's underpinned, well, side pinned. It's bound together all the way by really strong communication, right? And that allows the person currently in the job to do what the community needs. right? Then, because it's a role, not a single person's particularly interesting job, underneath it we have a people and a workforce that exist at the moment and are being developed for the future. As a result of that, we get outcomes. We help to catalyse outcomes for customers, companies, regulators, and for the whole system, right? So some of the outcomes that we help to generate affect the whole health system. We don't get there in a concerted way unless we have a philosophy of the role, which is shared across the occupants in that role. And we also do not keep producing that unless we have the ethical and professional base for the role. So all of those things. You will look back at the last 7 years, you'll see action on each of those elements. The question is, what needs to happen for the next 7 years? So I've taken 40 minutes. Have we got 20 minutes left? Okay. There are some questions, but general open for comment as well. And finally, the aim in doing this is to get this kind of discussion outside the closed group of the appointed actuaries and into the rest of the profession.
Thanks for that, Stuart. Before you open up for questions, probably might ask Gail or Fike if they have any views on the AA role in the last 7 years. Nope. Fair enough. If you have any questions, please approach the mic, say your name, and speak clearly.
Gail Ganane. I've sort of been listening with interest because this is kind of my baby. I mean, this is part of the regulator that I... But one of the things I'm looking at now, though, is I'm a director of a health fund, but I'm also on two other health-related boards, and I think there's a whole bunch of things that are starting to intermingle around the way in which health is trying to go, which is the preventive programs. But I can't actually see any evidence, A, that any of them work. I mean, I think it's been the economics of cigarette smoking that's cut back smoking rather than all of the government health plans, because I don't smoke and I can tune that stuff out, and I'm sure smokers are better at it than I am. I'm... In my role on the Division of General Practice, the shift to Medicare Local is about trying to put in place preventative health and things like that. But one of the things that concerns me a little is I'm seeing health make a lot of these changes, but there's not necessarily an advice base behind it. There's a real... We want to do things better. Government has broad ideas. But, you know, I think there's a role for actuaries there too. Maybe I'm trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel a bit. But I'm concerned that there isn't an evidence base for a lot of the things that are happening either in the health insurance space or in the broader health space, and trying to stretch that out. We're going, as the director of a health fund, going to get caught in this a little bit because some of those costs are going to be shifted from government to the health fund. Mm. The sovereign risk issues about the rebate and all of those are still bubbling away there. And I suspect the outcome is going to be pretty much more of the same, but the objective is much different from that. And if we have more of the same, we've got real problems with financing healthcare and all of those things, and we're not getting anywhere. So I'm just, I suppose, I'm not providing any answers. I don't know what the answers are. It really is a wicked problem. There's no obvious solutions. But if actuaries can't be part of that, you know, they're the informed people that can use the modelling and the skills and the techniques to actually do that. So I encourage you to expand that role into other parts of health.
Andrew Gale. I think, Stuart, thank you very much for that paper and presentation. When you put all that up, and I did look through the paper, it can appear quite daunting when you see what we've actually signed up for. And I think that's actually very important, I think, because we need to continually remind ourselves that we haven't reached the end point. Despite all the hard work that's gone on before, and I know a lot of us were there from the very start, and you know, we feel that we've achieved something important, and I think that's right, but we haven't reached the end point. In some ways, to use your 7-Up analogy, I mean, we've just grown from babies to children, and there's still a lot more growing to go. So it'd be interesting if someone writes this paper in 7 years' time and see where we're at. And we do have a lot of strengths. You know, we need to acknowledge that. We are a small and tightly knit group who are all willing to contribute to our collective professional development understanding. And we probably take a lot of that for granted. I agree with your comment that the test is really going to be in the next generation, when it goes beyond something that we can get people together in a small room, even in a room like this where we can't really have everybody there at once to have that crystal clear. So to me, it's clear that the role is going to change and develop, and that we need to change and develop with it. And that it is important that we do that for the success of and stability of the private health insurance industry.
I'd just make that comment about the daunting. I realised when I finished talking that I had picked out all the scary bits. But a part of what I'm saying here, it's really important that people who are not currently appointed actuaries are health insurance appointed actuaries in 2, 3, 4 years' time. It's really important. And the people currently in the job won't automatically stand aside. So there needs to be a commercial pressure as well. But then the job of the profession is to help the people coming along to deal with those daunting aspects. And by stories, by training, by case studies, by allowing people to undershadow, by a really effective system of peer review, help people deal with the bits that are daunting. Because we won't stop them from being daunting, and it would be dangerous if we did. What we need to do is deal with, equip people to be able to deal with daunting problems.
Hi, Bronwyn Hardy. This is the plug for the Health Insurance Online CPD course. So we have just updated it and we are about to relaunch it. There are new flyers up at the Institute desk. So if you're interested in doing the course, please enrol. It's not that expensive. It's a really awesome course. And, it's marked by all the appointed actuaries, past and present. Pretty much are on the marking list, and you know, people are happy to discuss the course with you and the results with you, so I hope you enjoy it.
I'll reinforce that plug. One of the successful things that happened the first time we launched it was that a lot of non-actuaries did it. We saw the feedback from including direct directors of health insurers, and we're about to mail out again and encourage finance people generally, even product people, and certainly boards new directors to have at least a read through the material.
Trying to be probably a bit more controversial, Stuart, I'll ask you a question. Currently, I guess, appointed actuaries are getting sort of feedback or peer review from the AGA and FIAC. Do you think that, or maybe it's a question for the room as well as for you, do you think there could be a scope for, say, external peer review actuaries on the PHI appointed actuaries in the next 7 years?
I'm not sure that's a good idea. The reason I'm not sure it's a good idea is because you would have to do it, I think you'd have to do it for every insurer. You could make a case that it would be worth doing for the big insurers, but if you single them out, I think that should be a decision they make themselves, and then it would also be logical for them to decide when they would do that. And once you start getting to that level, you probably find that the big insurers already get some peer review on things they find really difficult from whatever source. So I don't think there's much role for it in a formal sense. It's also a bit reinforced by the little bit I've seen of that role in the other insurance sectors. It tends to be all one way. There's not much mileage for the peer reviewer in saying, oh, I'll let this go, it doesn't matter, right? You get no kudos for saying it doesn't matter when it doesn't matter, and you get plenty of problems if you say it doesn't matter when it does. So No, I don't think a formal external peer review role. And then finally, I do think peer review is really important when you're dealing with any important problem that you've never dealt with before. Right. So I bring it back from a kind of formal thing to more a way that the profession operates, that when we're dealing with an issue which we're new to, we find a way of testing what we're doing using the brain of one of our colleagues. Here's someone from the AGA. I think they should do it.
You might regret that.
I do. I regret it already. I take that back. Okay, when we edit this tape, that won't appear.
Michael Burt, just a few, and I think I'll probably call these personal observations, given my particular employer and roles for various people. Oddly enough, I will actually start with one that wasn't intended to comment on, which is this external peer review. I'm actually not a great fan of external peer review, but I'm an extremely big fan of internal peer review. I quite often find that external peer review is a hindrance rather than a help, whereas I think internal peer review can be extremely valuable if done properly and well and in the right environment. So I'd be a big fan of internal, but I'm not convinced that external tends to make it much more formal, so you then have a guidance note and then people are going tick, 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 which brings me back to one of the comments I was going to make, which is that as a sort of infrequent use of FCRs and actuarial advice provided by the appointed actuaries, there does seem to be a bit of a tendency, and this follows on from a comment made by David Torrens yesterday about the new professional standard, there does seem to be a tendency to default to the rules. And what I mean, the rules are the FIAC solvency and cap adequacy requirements, that sort of stuff, the legislative requirements, rather than actuaries looking at the issue from first principles. And I feel that's potentially a weakness in what's happening at the moment, and could get worse if the professional standard, is it 600?
Yeah. Oh, what is it? Yeah, 600.
600 gets much more prescriptive about you must do this, you must do that. It tends to encourage this tick-a-box philosophy. And certainly, I mean, I've seen FCRs which I think have missed quite significant issues because they're looking at the rules rather than they're looking at the issues from first principles. And certainly I'd encourage anybody who's an appointed actuary not only to look at the rules, but then actually step back and say, OK, this complies with the rules, but is it desirable, or is there something else I should be looking at in this particular instance? I mean, I know one of the common... trying to think of the right phrase here because I don't want to be too inflammatory, but certainly if you have a big property at the moment, one of the ways of getting round the rules is to actually strata title it. But at the end of the day, you still have one big property, even though it might be split into 5, 10, 15, 20 strata titles. To me, that says that's a risk because underlying it is one property, not 20 properties. And I'm just using that as an example, but I mean, other people think of it. The other thing that I get the impression people are quite sensitive to is where you're talking about assets that are key to the employer. So things like big subsidiaries, stuff like that. Look, I'll keep going very quickly. So I can't even read my own writing, sorry about this. The final comment is that, and this is an impression, is that I still get the impression a lot of actuaries don't feel entirely comfortable with their roles of being an appointed actuary. They still don't feel at home commenting in certain areas. And so I think that would be something that would be nice if I could come back and say, if this was run in 7 years' time, I could say, yeah, the actuaries really do feel at home in this area. At the moment, I don't think a lot of people do feel entirely comfortable with their role. So, again, it's been very useful and it's great to see where it's got to, but I think it's still a work in progress rather than completed task.
Go on, Brent.
Stuart, I just want to thank you very much for the paper. I think you've done a brilliant job with what you've done, and it's really pointing the way to the future. Actually, it makes me shudder a little bit, thinking all the responsibilities that I had, or I have. I wanted to respond a little bit to what Gail said. We have to be brave. I mean, we were brave getting to this point, extremely brave. We would have never have got here if we didn't seize the moment when the moment came. And the real moment came when, back in 1989, when the Razor Gang went through the Department of Health and some smart aleck suggested to them, hey, I know how you can fix your problem and get rid of 75 people, set up an independent regulator for private health insurance. And that was the moment, that was the turning point which actually got us involved, because in doing that it meant that actuaries and auditors had to be employed by health funds instead of department people. So that was a turning point. And what I'm going to suggest is that look for those moments when you can really do something. Now, there is, I think, at the present time, like there was back in the mid-1970s when I wrote a paper on called Health Insurance and advocated lifestyle rating, I think there is a time about now to do something about the epidemic of obesity. And I think we would get a lot of encouragement from politicians and society if we did something about that. I'm not sure exactly how it should be done. Whoever does it is going to be prepared to wear a few bruises, because a lot of people won't like what you're doing. And certainly, way back in 1976, the medical profession hated me for what I was suggesting. The actuarial profession hated me. The insurers didn't like it. Nobody wanted it. And yet it happened, and it worked. And so, I think we're at the same position in time again now. Anyway, I'll leave it with that.
Thanks, Brent. Can I... two things. Gail talked about the Medicare locals. In my firm, we have an economist unit and we have an actuarial unit. And what's the difference? We are really strong when we are helping to manage a financial structure that has to deliver to end users, right? That's the Medicare local. That's not the national health system. Deloitte Access economists, do that. But when Brent talks about there is a moment when something can be done, pick that moment, it just strikes me that the Medicare locals being formed around the place have a lot of the characteristics of an individual financial structure. And there's a question for us about, can we apply a similar role in those individual institutions?
I think we're out of time. Can you please join me in thanking Stuart for his excellent talk and paper?
Thanks.